Are you a big brain of the beautiful game? Prove it with the great new app that'll test your football knowledge to the limit. Name That Player. Download the Name That Player app today and race against the clock to identify the Premier League players purely from a list of the clubs they've played for. Put your football knowledge to the ultimate test with the Name That Player app. Available right now for iOS and Android from the App Store and Google Play. Name That Player. Can you beat the best?
Shoot the defence, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
That should be the club legend. It's just totally disrespectful. And like I say, it's just a lack of respect, lack of class. And I hope we get relegated and liquidated.
Jan, do you want to do that voice of your barber so we can guess which nationality he is?
Are you ready?
Sounds like a really bad porno, mate.
And the fact that we had now taken our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable. And with very young players, so it was...
Yeah, but I've seen misses, like, you
but
know...
But that wasn't a miss.
Misses, what he misses, he stopped his mate from scoring it.
I'm Mike Pieri, and I have the privilege of talking to a former England international today who plied his trade with West Bromwich Albion, Sheffield Wednesday, Southampton, Leeds and Coventry. He's a player who divides opinion, but it's fair to say that fans of clubs he's played for have nothing but praise and respect for a player who's been described by them as wholehearted, fiercely competitive, irreplaceable and deserving of all his England call-ups and vital to our success. He's still revered in South Yorkshire, where his time with Sheffield Wednesday coincided with the club enjoying plenty of success in a team that had power and flair. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased and excited to welcome Mr. Carlton Palmer to the show. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Good evening, Mike.
Good evening. Let's start at the beginning, Carlton. It's true to say that West Bromwich Albion were your first football love. You signed for them from school, played 121 games, scoring 4 goals. Take us through the journey, you know, from when you were a schoolboy to signing your professional footballer contract, making your debut for the club you watched from the stands. How were you scouted? Can you describe what life was like as an apprentice in that era? Any chores you were given, responsibilities, attitude of senior players to you? I mean, at the end of the day, it's every boy's dream, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, I didn't actually start at West Brom. I actually started at Chelsea as a young boy. I was a schoolboy at Chelsea. And, you know, everything was going well. And then I had a bad break coming up to about my 15th birthday. And that's an important time when you're looking to sign on at a club. I was out for a long time and Chelsea weren't sure that I was going to recover from that. So they didn't take the option of the contract on. So I was out for a while. And actually took my boots and went on trials to clubs, went to Birmingham, got down to the last two or three and still didn't get signed on. And then, fortunately for me, I managed to be offered a YTS at West Bromwich Albion, just before my 16th birthday. So I was given a year there. And still, things didn't go straightforward for me because, you know, when all of these guys had been there before, we had players who had been captain of England schoolboys, captain of Wales. They had a very big squad, a strong squad, and it was looking like, you know, I hadn't played in the reserves, and it wasn't going well for me at all. And then, as I say, you know, whether it's fate or whatever, Ron Atkinson took over, and the youth team coach at the time was Nobby Stiles, and Nobby must have said, well, I know for a fact Nobby had said to Ron, he's the best young player we've got at the club, but he's not been given a chance, you know, I was then put in the reserves, and then Ron put me in there against Birmingham in a local derby, and as they say, the rest is history. But it wasn't all plain sailing at all, and this is now when I coach and I tell the young kids that it's how bad you want something, how bad you really, you know, want to do something, and I was prepared to take my boots and go and travel to other clubs And you know, I make no bones about this. I had edge. In terms of technical ability, I wasn't the best, but in terms of fitness-wise, I made myself one of the fittest players in the country, if not the fittest player in the country.
Mm. I mean, I remember watching you, Carl. I mean, I'm 41 years old now, so I remember watching in the Sheffield Wednesday team of the early 90s. I believe Johnny Giles was in charge when you played your first senior game. What advice did he give you, and did it come to a shock to you to be involved on your first match day? How did that feel? Give our listeners an insight.
Well, obviously, when you get selected, I mean, then when you're going on about dreams, I mean, I used to go and watch West Brom. My dad used to take me to West Brom. I used to, you know, stand in the Gully Road end and, you know, watch the likes of Cyril and Brendan Batson, Laurie Cunningham, you know, Brian Robson, you know, mm-hmm. all these great players. And then to be told, you know, I'm going to make my debut for my hometown club, it was unbelievable. And then obviously you're obviously nervous, you're young and whatever. And for me, I was lucky enough, we played Birmingham City, we won and I got man of the match. So,
fantastic.
You know, great feeling to play for the club that you supported as a kid, you know.
Superb. You played under Ron Atkinson at West Brom and then he signed you for Sheffield Wednesday. Was it an easy decision to make?
No, it was a difficult decision for me to make because at the time, Sheffield Wednesday, it was a transfer deadline day and West Brom was struggling for money. So on the day, Dave Burrows and Steve Ball and myself were pulled in by the chairman to say, listen, we've got to sell all three of you to get some money in. You know, Dave Burrows went to Liverpool, Bully went to Wolves, and I had a host of clubs after me. And Ken Bates was on the phone to me at Chelsea. They were flying at the time. And that was probably the move I should have made. But Nobby Stiles said to me, listen, Colton, don't even think about it. Get up the road with Big Ron to Sheffield Wednesday. And without a shadow of a doubt, it was less money, far less money than all the other clubs that had offered me. But it was the best decision I'd ever made. It's not only been the best 10 years of my life playing football there, it was the best, not best 10 years of my footballing career, best 10 years of my life.
Wow.
And the players I met, who are still my friends now, you know, it was just a great family and a great experience. And I still live in Sheffield to this day.
Excellent. I mean, as I said earlier, I remember watching that Wednesday team in the 90s, and I would say that you were just as important as David Hurst, Chrissy Waddle and Sheridan. And that midfield pairing of you and Sheridan was as good as any at the time, in my opinion. I mean, sorry?
There wasn't a better... it's up to... People can have their own opinions, but if you talk about Man United and Inter and Scalzi, they couldn't deal with us. We had a good balance about us. We, you know, I had the legs,
yeah.
and John Sheridan was as good a passer of the ball as anybody in the country. So, you know, both of us could have played in any of those top sides at that time, and we were one of the top sides then. So, we had a good balance between the team. Ron Atkinson is a great man manager, and he's great at putting teams together with characters that gel. And in that team, I think 10 of the team went on to be managers.
Mm.
10 of the team.
And that just shows the character of the players and also what they got from the managers they played under and the coaches they were with, I guess.
Well, I think that no disrespect to any of the coaches, it was down to the manager.
Right.
He was, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, he was fantastic in the way that he did things tactically. And I'm not being disrespectful to Ron Atkinson, he wasn't really a tactical person.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the game of football. He put good players together and wanted to play a certain style of football. And his philosophy was, I'm not bothered about the other team. I'm only bothered about what we do and how we play. And that's the way we played. And he wanted us to pass and move. And that's what we did. He got us fit.
Mm-hmm.
But we had fun doing it. We had fun. We played a brand of football that was enjoyable. And Ron's last thing he used to say to us before we went out is, I'm going upstairs now and I'm a paying member of the public. Entertain me.
Wow.
And he would never give you a
So he gave it a confidence to, I mean, I'm a football coach as well, but at under 11, I've got a little under 11 team. And I always tell the kids, try it. Don't be afraid to try it. And with Big Ron, I guess, he gave it that confidence. You know, try it. Take the player on. Go down the line. Make something happen rather than some managers who I feel are scared to play, are scared to allow their players that flair, you know, that opportunity to do something different because they're more afraid of losing than they are of trying to go for the win.
Well, it's a different era now. It's a business now. It's a big business. I don't necessarily agree with it now. Managers are under too much pressure now. They can't manage like Ron Atkinson used to anymore because they haven't got that length of time. They just don't have it. So they can't chuck that young player in and give him a chance to either sink or succeed. Mm-hmm. They've got to go for tried and tested, and they've got to get results. So, but in our day, managers were given a little bit more time, well, a lot more time, and so they were a lot more adventurous in how they played. And Ron certainly wouldn't, even today, Ron wouldn't be the type of person who'd worry about getting a sack. He would play the way that he wants his team to play.
Right. How different was working under Ron Atkinson with working with under Trevor Francis?
Well, funny enough, I didn't particularly get on with Trevor when he became a manager. When he was a player, I got on really well with him. Trevor, he inherited a very good side. He tried to put his stamp on it, and he should have really just left it alone because even when we were winning, people were saying it was Ron Atkinson's team and he didn't like that. He wanted to put his stamp on it. So he quickly broke up everything that Ron had built up there when he should have just embraced it and went on with it. And ironically, I think, you know, you've got to remember now, you've got a lot of big characters in that dressing room. You've got me, you've got Erste, you've got Danny Wilson, you've got Viv Anderson, you've got Nigel Pearson, you've got Roland Nielsen, you've got Nigel Worthington at left back. You've got big characters in that dressing room. Mark Bright up front. You've got to be careful, and you've got to be a certain kind of person to be able to deal with that. Ironically, when Trevor went to Birmingham, he sold me. Trevor did from Sheffield Wednesday, but when he went to Birmingham, he realised he needed a strong character and a strong person, because if you get that type of person in your team, they almost do your job for you. That's why Dave Jones signed me to Southampton. He knew that I would do his job for him on the football pitch.
I mean, we have a lot of debates during our weekly review shows and on our Facebook page and on Twitter. And what you just said, you know, rings true with a lot of our Arsenal followers, where they haven't had a leader for so long. And, you know, a Carton Palmer, a Peter Shirtcliffe, a Roland Nielsen, Nigel Worthington, a Viv Anderson. That's something that the current Arsenal team, with all the flair and creativity they've got, have been crying out for. And you just make exactly the point that many people do make. Earlier you said, Carton, that your fitness was one of your biggest, things that you really, made you stand out as a footballer. But, you know, I know that, you know, having watched you covered every blade of grass, you broke up attacks, surged forward, tracked back. You know, apart from the fitness, what do you think was your best attribute as a footballer?
Well, I mean, I'm a competitor. I'm a winner. That's bottom line. I'm a winner in life. And so you've got to have that type of person in your team. We had players around. I mean, you check my passing statistics when I played the game. You know, I kept it simple, but my pass ratio was very high.
Mm-hmm.
Gaining possession. But the one thing about it, I always knew what my role was in the side. I knew what my job was in the side. If we were playing away, it could be Zola. If you speak to Gianfranco Zola, he knew that if we played Chelsea, he weren't getting a kick that day. Ray Wilkins will tell you that. Cantona will tell you that. There's not a player that I've been told to do a man-to-man on that over 90 minutes that I haven't had the better of them. So that was my job. The gaffer would say to me sometimes, listen, Colt, we're going to play 10 beats. We're going to make it 10 v 10 today. Mm-hmm. And you've got to do that. And that was it. And I enjoyed that part. I was a team player, and I was a character as well. I was a character. Strong person and a character, and you need those type of people in your time. I was never a troublemaker. I never by my club for disciplinary reasons or anything like that in my career.
Mm-hmm.
I like to win. in, and if I wasn't happy and things weren't right, there was time for me to move on.
Superb, excellent. I mean, as I've said before, Wednesday, Sheffield Wednesday fans still talk about that era, the era we just talked about, you know, Chris Waddle, David Hurst, you know, the partnership with Ewan Sheridan, Paul Warhurst as well. Still talk about that era. But being a player on that side, you must have had a lot of good memories from your time at a club. Are there any that stand out particularly?
Oh, there's so many. There's so many memories. I mean, incidentally, I've never done a book before because, I just feel that if you're an ex-player and you do a book, unless you're a big name, it doesn't really sell, because I would never tell stories on Gascoigne or Rushy or Yuzi or whatever to sell a book. I would never do that. But somebody said to me, and I'm quite lucky because I coach out in Shanghai now, my wife's a teacher, so I met an author who said to me, well, listen, let's just do a book and tell the stories, the football stories that you've got that, you know, that you enjoyed and that, you know, people will want to read about it. So that's what we're going to do. And I'll give you one memory of which will, you know, last with all the players who played in that cup final in 91. This is the type of manager Ron Atkinson was. We went down to cup final was on the Sunday, and we went down on the Thursday. We went down, and on the first night on the Thursday, we went down on one coach. The girls went down on the other coach. We went out to Rennie and Renato's restaurant, Italian restaurant. Ron had blocked it out. We had an unbelievable night. Let me tell you, nobody was sober. This is on the Thursday night before the cup final on the Sunday. On the Friday now, it's Trevor Francis's 40th birthday. Big Ron throws a party at the hotel we're staying next to Hyde Park and invites the chairman of Manchester United, Edwards, who's down in London for a Football League meeting, invites him to the party. They were actually coming down the night before on the Saturday, Man United. He must have gone back and said, hey, hang on a minute, this ain't a problem, because we were completely again drunk on the Friday night with Trevor Francis. So they now chose to fly down on the Saturday morning, right? Yeah. On the Sunday morning for the cup final. On the Saturday, our first training session on the Friday was in Hyde Park, where we put down four jumpers and had a five-a-side.
Superb.
We then go on the Saturday. No talk of Man United. We had Roland Nielsen, who'd been out for a year, coming back from a cruciate. It was going to mark then at that point, Giggsy. Nigel Pearson was going to take care of Sparky Hughes. And he just said to the boys, I remember, because unfortunately I was suspended for that game. I played all the games apart from the final. And he said to all the boys, he just said, listen, he said, not many people get to play in a cup final in their lifetime. Some very famous footballers have gone through their career. Go and enjoy it. He said, yeah, let's be right about it. If Man United turn up today, it's Man United win. But he said, if we play as well as what we can play and Man United don't turn up, he said, we'll have a chance. And to be fair, Chris Turner had an absolute blinder in goal. John Sheridan scored a magnificent goal. Nigel Pearson got man of the match. And the boys played out their skin. But that was all down to man management. He took the whole occasion and the importance of the whole occasion out of it and just made it a normal football match. But that was his brilliance.
Brilliant story, brilliant story. I thought you were going to mention the hat-trick v QPR before half-time as one of your highlights.
No, that was a great day. That was a great day because the boys were giving me a lot to speak about situations to score goals, and that was one of the things that let me down at times. I mean, ordinarily I'm a centre back. That's how I started. I was a defender. Big Ron would actually, you know, said he wish he had two of me, one to play at the back and one to play in the middle of the park. So ordinarily I'm a centre back, but I got into great positions and didn't score. So on this particular game, I mean, we were a good side, an entertaining side. On that day, you know, you had to feel sorry for QPR. All the lads were on form and we played a brand of football that day, which, you know, anybody could go and see. And unfortunate for me, I remember Ron saying to me, I've been working at it in the week, and he just said to me today, just make straight runs in the box. Just make straight runs in the box and you'll get goals today. And I did that. I made straight runs into the box and ended up with an hat-trick. But the best goal of the game was still scored by John Sheridan.
Yeah, that's right.
Unfortunately, in the second half, yeah, great move. It was an unbelievable
Yeah, one of your goals was a header, is that right, if I recall? Was it a header?
Yeah, no, I scored a proper hat-trick. I scored a left foot, right foot and header.
And a scramble on the near post, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, left foot, right foot and header.
Superb, superb. You were never one for shirking responsibility during a match, and you've been known to wind opponents up. Do you remember an incident with Jamie Pollock at Middlesbrough where you tried to get him on his feet after a tackle and John Henry got involved? Any other on-pitch incidents you'd like to share with our listeners or any stories on the pitch?
Oh, I mean, that's part of the game. It's like, you know, me and Shed, we're the biggest wind-up merchants of the lot. I mean, we'd start on anybody. Like, if we're playing Man United, you know, we'd start on Inti with his curly perm and whatever. we'd have them all, you know. If you gave us an excuse, we'd start and wind you up. I remember we're playing QPR at our place and Clinton Morris come out with a pair of gold boots. What a mistake that was for him. And we started on him in the tunnel and I think he was off before half time. He couldn't take it, you know what I mean? But that was us. We all the way through the team, we're all at it.
But that's the personalities, isn't it? That's the big personalities you had in a big team.
Absolutely. And if you can, you know, I always said to anybody, if you can wind me up and I get sent off, there's more fuel, mate. End of story.
Fair enough.
So, yeah.
Fair enough. So after over 200 appearances for Wednesday, you made the move to Leeds. And there you played with some more fantastic footballers. How did the move come about? And what was the main differences between Howard Wilkinson and Big Ron's approach to match day?
Well, it was a strange one. I'd agreed to go to... Well, straight away, as I said, Trevor Francis, I'd signed a 5-year contract at Sheffield Wednesday and I committed my career to, you know, the large part of my career to Sheffield Wednesday. 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from the chairman to say the manager didn't want me because the chairman didn't meet my deal while Trevor was away at the World Cup. Trevor had rang up and said he wanted to move me on. So I said to the chairman, fair enough. He told me that Leeds United and Aston Villa had matched. Alan Shearer had just gone for £3.2 million. They'd both matched £2.8 million, which was making me the second highest transfer at the time in the country. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to Ron Atkinson and agreed a deal to go to Aston Villa. But Ron had gone to the World Cup, and where I live in Sheffield, Howard Wilkinson was my next door neighbour. So Howard had matched the offer and asked me to come and have talks. And my advisors at the time said, listen, if somebody's offered the second highest transfer fee for you in the country, you should at least do the decency of going to talk to him. And I went over to Leeds United and I was thoroughly bowled over by Howard. He's still a very, very good friend of mine now. And, you know, so me and Ron fell out about that. But I said to Ron, if he, you know, he should have been here, he should have got the deal wrapped up and done and dusted, and I wouldn't have gone and spoke to Leeds United. And, you know, the opportunity of playing with Gary McAllister, Gary Speed, David Batty,
Gordon Strachan, you know, as well.
Gordon Strachan, and to work with a manager that was completely different to Ron. I'd never worked with somebody who was so attention to detail. And both managers' styles work in their different ways. You know, Howard was very much a fitness guy. He was a student of the game. He was up on all of the modern technology that's been used now. We were doing all that, all the things that they're doing now that they think they invented. We were all doing that in 92. Mm-hmm. All of that yoga and all of that, Howard had brought all of that in. It was a great move for me and a great time for me at Leeds United, and I think I became a better player. At the time as well, with Howard, I felt at the time, players that were coming through into the England side in midfield, I thought I was going to struggle to keep my place in the England side. Mm-hmm. So I was going to go back and play at centre-back. That was my decision with Howard, which I felt that, you know, no disrespect to Gareth Southgate, I believe I was a better player than Gareth Southgate, so I believed I would get, you know, keep my England place in that team. But it wasn't to be, you know. But I don't regret making the move. I didn't get capped again, but you know, I had a great time at Leeds United.
I mean, you mentioned that you played with Gary McAllister, Gary Speed, Gordon Strachan. You know, how different was that midfield to the one that you had in Sheffield Wednesday? I mean, the Leeds one, not many people got the better of them, did they?
No. We had everything in that Leeds midfield. You know, Gary Speed was one of the best. I mean, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
He scored 16 goals a season from the left wing, coming in at the far post. It was phenomenal. We had speed, we had pace, we had strength. Gary McAllister, I've said, and I'll go on record as saying that dead ball situations, he's as good as David Beckham. If the boss said to him to put a ball in a particular area, he would do it, and he would do it first time. He's as good as midfield player I've ever played with. And then you've got the little terrier in Gordon Strachan. Even at his age at the time there, he was still one of the best players in the Premier League. So we had everything. We had every mix.
Excellent. When did you know your time at Leeds was up? And did you find out? When did you find out Southampton were after your services? Did you speak to David Hurst before making the decision to move south? Because he'd already moved down there, didn't he?
No, he hadn't moved. David Hurst, he moved because of me.
Ah.
He hadn't moved. No, what happened was George Graham took over. Really didn't like the man, I'll be truthful with you. Yeah. Took over. You know, everybody's got their opinions, but there's a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things.
Sure.
And, you know, he'd come in, he targeted myself, Rushy, all the big wage earners. He just wanted us out of the football club. But there's a right way to do it and the wrong way to do it. So he basically turned around to me. Everton were in for me, West Ham were in for me, and he said to me, there's no way you're going to any of those clubs to embarrass me. So he said, you're either going to the Championship or... you know, that was the situation at the time. I just signed a new 4-year contract at Leeds United. I was earning good money. But the one thing for me is I needed to play football. And this guy, he doesn't give two oats, as you know. Mm. He's done it with other players at Arsenal before. He will leave you out of the team, and that's what he did. And so I get a call from my man telling me that Dave Jones at Southampton wants to speak to me. Mm. 7 points adrift at the bottom of the Premier League. There's only, what, 8 games in or something like that. But I go and meet Dave Jones in Manchester. He flew up to see me and I got on really well with him. I just liked him. Even to this day, he's a good pal of mine. And so I flew down and we lengthy negotiations, but we're a million miles away from the money. Obviously, Southampton weren't paying that type of money then at the time.
Sure.
But the players he promised me he was going to bring in, the likes of Mark Hughes, he was talking to me about Ersty at the time. And the chairman just turned around and said to me, like, listen, would you sign for this football club? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So he said, leave it with me for 24 hours. And we found an halfway mark. They gave me a longer contract because of my age, and, mm-hmm. and we found a way that worked. And we went down to Southampton and had a brilliant time. And we went from there to nearly finishing Europe in that first season.
Superb. You said that you sort of fell out with Big Ron when you didn't sign for Villa. But he signed you again, though, didn't he? Nottingham Forest, in the hope that you could help them survive the drop.
Me and Big Ron will always be friends. Always be friends. He was mad at me at the time. We soon get over that. I'm in Birmingham now, and I'll go and see Big Ron tomorrow and have lunch with him and Maggie. We'll always be big friends. So yeah, when Ron got the, well, he was away in Barbados at the time. I think he was met Irving Scholar in Barbados.
Of course he was.
And he offered him the job, and he rang me up and he said, you know, I was at Southampton at the time. He said, look, Carlton, listen. Because what happened, you know, to be fair, I was travelling from Sheffield to Southampton at the time, and it was a long old journey, and my ex-wife at the time had just got pregnant, mm-hmm. and so I had 3 young kids, I couldn't move them at that point, it was a sad day for me to leave Southampton because they offered me a new contract and offered me, you know, a lot of money to stay, but I just. It was better for me to come back north, and I did that to Forest, and it didn't work out. To be fair, mm-hmm. there were a poor side, a lot of problems going on, and it was an unhappy time for me. That, to be fair,
mm-hmm. That was around the time when Pierre van Hooijdonk had just called off his self-imposed strike. What kind of atmosphere was it? I mean, you said it wasn't a good time. Did that play a part?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. It wasn't good. it wasn't good in the dressing room, you know, and it wasn't good to say the least. And you know, that in itself would cause the major part of Nottingham Forest being relegated that season, to be fair.
Shame. Gordon Strachan then twisted your arm to join him at Coventry, where he was building a decent squad. Gary McAllister and Noel Whelan were already there, as was a certain Robbie Keane. And you've played with some fantastic strikers in your time. Where would you put Robbie Keane if you were to make a top five list or a top 10 list?
Strachan came on to me and he got me out of the situation I was in at Forest. It was a great move for me back to the Premier League. And he was building a good side, as you say. He just signed Adji, he just signed Chipo. Maka was there, and Maka was as fit as anything and playing well. And then he signed Robbie, and Robbie's up there. Robbie's a top player. He reminded me a lot of Teddy Sheringham in his movement. Not the quickest, but great touch, great movement, great goal scorer. I mean, I played with so many top player strikers. It would be hard to put Robbie in the top five, but he's certainly up there. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, I've played with Ersty, you know, I've played with Lineker, played with Ian Wright, played with Les Ferdinand, played with Mark Hughes. It's hard to, you know, put him above those type of quality. Mm-hmm. But he's definitely in the mix. Definitely.
Excellent. You had two loan spells, Watford and Sheffield Wednesday, before taking the managerial plunge with Stockport and Mansfield. What made you decide to go into management?
Well, I just got to that point, you know, when you've been playing a long time. Big Ron had actually said to me, I made a massive mistake. He said, play as long as you can. But I just got to that point where to keep the level of fitness that I had, I had to work hard. I mean, when I say, you know, people used to say it was natural. It wasn't natural. I worked two evenings a week and have done for many years with a personal fitness instructor to work on core work, strength, sprinting, mm-hmm. balance, weights, everything. And so it was getting harder and harder to maintain that level of fitness. Without that level of fitness, I can't perform. Mm-hmm. So an opportunity presented itself with me to go to Stockport as player manager. And I felt that was the right time. Financially, I was secure, so it was the right time for me to do that. It was a difficult circumstances at the time, but the chairman, again, Brendan Elwood, was a fantastic bloke, a footballing bloke, and to be fair, you know, I had 2.5, nearly 3 years there with fantastic and with a great young side, and unfortunately. My chairman, we did a fantastic job, me and Kevin Richardson, in terms of... See, there's two facets of managers, which you can't come out and talk about because you can't say things like that. When a club's in financial trouble, mm-hmm. which Stockport was at the time, not financial trouble in terms of they don't have any money because Brendan Elwood's a multi-millionaire, but he was bankrolling the club.
Yeah.
You know, they were in the Premier League, got relegated in the Championship, and they were still paying, they were in the Championship, still paying big money to players, and then getting relegated. So, you know, what we had to do was get the big wage earners out, which I did in the Sheffield Cookies, got £1.2 million for him, got players out who were on big contracts, paid them up, and then we had a lot of good young kids who, you know, one of them, I bought Ricky Lambert in a Stockport county from Macclesfield at the time, me and Rico. Oh. And I told him, I said to him at the first day, I said, with all that ability you've got, you master that fitness side of it, mm-hmm. You'll go on to play for England. And he did do. So we saw a lot of good young players. John Daly was playing up at Glasgow Rangers.
Yeah.
We signed a lot of good young players, and it was just unfortunate that my chairman was off levels for the first time in a long time with the club because we'd sorted it out financially. And then a new owner came in, Brian Kennedy, and obviously straight away, he's not a footballing bloke, you knew that. He just wanted the club as a rugby club, so, you know, a player manager like me earning the money that I'm earning, he got me out and brought Sammy McElroy on way, 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 way less money than what I am. And eventually, even when I see Brendan now, he's ruined the club, to be fair.
Sure. So you had two stints as manager. Is it something you feel you've tried and will not go back to you, especially given the unfortunate abuse you got from Mansfield fans at your last managerial post?
Yeah, Mansfield was an horrible one. It was an horrible one. It was one of those where Keith Haslam's a friend of mine, and it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't something that was meant to be. He had a problem with Keith Curl over an incident that Keith was involved with. He rang me up. I suppose I was working with the BBC. He asked me to do the game for him on the Saturday. Mm-hmm. I did the game on the Saturday, and we won. He asked me to do the game on the Tuesday while he sorted out whatever, and we won. Then we had a cup game. And so, I mean, apparently, I still think I've got the best record for a manager to start off at Mansfield in many a year. Mm-hmm. So in the end, the chairman and the directors offered me the job. But the supporters, because I was friends with Keith, didn't want me there. They obviously had a feeling towards Keith Till because he took them to the playoffs.
Yeah.
But what they forget, he also let all of the players get out of contract. All of those players that were in that side, good side, they lost 10 players because he let them all go out of contract.
Wow.
And so it was a major problem when I took over. These players, they were in the last year of their contracts, didn't want to sign new contracts because they're in a position now where they can negotiate more money. Mm-hmm. They were doing well. And so, you know, we lost the likes of Liam Lawrence and people like that. It was just a difficult job, and then when you're putting your own money into it, like I was, with you know, if you're playing on a morning at Torquay, and you can't afford to go overnight, but you're sorting it out personal, and the fans are abusing you, you know, it's a nightmare. And I felt like coming out and saying, right, hang on a minute, listen. And sometimes as a manager, and I bet you there's loads of managers in the country who wish they could do it. Hey, listen, our budget was $630,000. Mm-hmm. That was our budget. It's third from bottom in the league. From bottom in the league. So if you want anything better than that, which is playoffs or whatever, then the budget needs to be about £1.5 million in that league. That's as simple as it is. You go through all the leagues now. It's governed by money.
Of course it is.
It's governed by money. People, to punch above their weight, they've got to be in a job for a long period of time, which doesn't happen now.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fans are giving me stick. Look what's happened since then. And the only reason why they've done better in recent time is the new chairman who's come in has upped the budget.
He's up hand in his pocket,
the budget
yeah.
in the club, so they can bring better players in.
That's what it is. But, yeah, about,
to answer your question, to go back into football, the answer is absolutely no. No chance. I was with Nigel Pearson last week, with Nigel and Nicky, very, very good friend of mine, to see what Leicester have done to him. You know, forget whatever, he's kept him in the Premier League. You know, they've sacked him, managers are under pressure from day one, referees are under pressure. You look at the game of football now, and I love football, I live, breathe, eat football.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at the game of football now, it's all choreographed to a certain degree because everybody's frightened of losing their jobs.
Sure.
And what they forget is, like, now you go down the leagues, a lot of those players in the third division, they'll not finish playing football and be able to retire. No chance. Left to go and get another job.
Sure.
You know, it's a tough business. There's only the Premiership and some of the clubs in the Championship who are paying big money, right, that these players can, you know, not have to worry about retirement. The rest of them don't. So you've got a manager now who's on $75,000 a year, say, in the second division or whatever, with a break clause of 1 month salary or 2 months salary, right? And then he's out of work again after 4 months. And you've got kids to feed, kids to go to university.
Mortgage
and stuff
to pay
like that.
And all that, yeah.
No, not for me, mate.
Yeah.
Not for me. Unless Brendan Elwood bought another football club or Keith Haslam, and they offered me the job, of which I know that they would give me the time to do whatever would needed to be done, then I wouldn't do it. Because now you've got short-term managers.
Yeah.
Managers aren't going to come in and bother about the youth team and the reserves because they haven't got the time.
And also, there's this conveyor belt, isn't it? I mean, you know, you mentioned Nigel Pearson, and we've debated it on the show as well. You know, the timing was strange, and you know, there may have been stuff behind the scenes, and fine, whatever. But to bring in someone like Claudio Ranieri, who on the show we're not great fans of, because we're also from Greek background, and we saw what we did with Greece. Why don't give a younger manager a chance at the Premier League? Surely that's less of a gamble to bring in someone from abroad who's had quite a checkered and not a very successful past in terms of managing. But that was a strange one for us as well.
Well, we'll see. Because let me tell you, don't get fooled by the opening day of the season.
Yeah.
Right? Wait till he gets 10 games in. I know for a fact that when I was going in with Nigel and Craig in pre-season, he lost the one quality player he had in Cambiasso.
Yes.
Those players there, you know, no disrespect for them, ran through a brick wall for Nigel Pearson.
That's right.
And it will remain to see. I still think that they will be struggling come the end of the season. I think it was a terrible decision, and I've got nothing against Claudio Ranieri, but he's been 9 years out of the Premier League.
Absolutely.
As you said, you know. So at the end of the day, let's wait and see. The for me, I believe what goes around comes around. So we'll just see what happens. Every club that sacked Sam Allardyce or a party company with Sam Allardyce, because apparently he doesn't play a certain style of football. The three clubs I know have got relegated since they've got rid of him.
That's right,
and I know Slaven Bilic has started off fantastically at Arsenal, and I know Slaven, and he's a great bloke. But again, West Ham, after the job that Sam's done.
No, again, I'm a Sam Allardyce fan, and I get pelters on the show about it. But I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with you.
Well, when people talk about Sam, well, you know, he plays a certain style of football, and he got them out of that division at the first time. But don't tell me Sam Allardyce's teams don't play football. The Bolton side with Anelka, Cocho, Gary Speed, Campo, El Hadj Diouf. Don't tell me that they didn't play football. What they did, which is a bit like us at Leeds, we played phase one football.
Mm.
We played when the ball hit Chappie's feet.
Yeah.
We played from there, and we played with the likes of McAllister, Strachan, Speed and whatever. But we played phase one. If the ball went to the right fullback in Mel Sterling, and he could play it wide to Gordon Strachan, or he could play it infield to Gary McAllister, we play. But if it wasn't on, we lit Chappie and we set off. He played that way with Bolton, and then they set up their phase of football.
That's right.
Now, at the end of the day, the game's about getting results.
Yeah, absolutely. I love you said that. I've got someone on my side now. Thanks for that, Colton. During researching, I came across an anecdote where it to me it said a lot about how you are as a person. Because you were advised against bringing Brian Robson to Stockport to help with training, because your friends and people who were looking out for you at the club felt that if Robson impressed, he would actually go on and take your job. But your thoughts were that you would try anything to help the team, putting the team first and not yourself. And I thought this was a refreshing attitude. Could this unselfish attitude be one reason your time as a manager wasn't as successful as you wanted it to be?
Well, listen, how can you not, if somebody like Brian Robson offers to give you help? He's a pal of mine. I've known Brian for years. He's helped me an awful lot. He's been a good mate. I know his whole family and whatever. He lives in just off our training ground in Altrincham.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't I take him up on that offer? You know, Robbo's not that type of person, and I know that.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't a problem. It was only going to benefit me, Brian Robson coming in and helping with the training and helping the lads and whatever. So, no, I mean, I've always been old school,
mm-hmm.
and I've always been like that. And I'm not, you know, in this present era we live in, you know, it's people want you to say what they want you to say. I'll be truthful now. You look at the BBC. I was working at the BBC. I started at the same time as Lee Dixon, Martin Keown, and all of them. And no disrespect, I'm a good commentator. I know how to analyse a football game. I know. But you see, the thing is, right, I will say it as it is. And they want people, and this is how they want it in the game, people who want to say what they want to say. That's why, you know, when I spoke to them at the BBC, they said to me, well, we don't see you doing any more than that show on a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. So I went off to Dubai to do my coaching and work for the TV company out there.
Yeah.
You know, it's people that fit. And I don't subscribe to the black thing. I don't go down that route. When people ask me, do you think it's a black thing? I don't think it is. I've never been brought up to think that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think people like people who conform, who are, you know, I, you hear a lot of what he does is prompted to him anyhow. So somebody who's natural, who can do it like I did it and whatever, but I won't conform and I won't just say what they want me to say. I will say it as I see it and as it should be said. So if you're watching at home, when you listen to me commentate, you will think, well, hang on a minute, this is not just a professional outlook, but this is an outlook from a supporter's point of view as well.
I mean, I'll come back to that later, because I made a note of that, that, you know, listening to you commentating in your punditry, you do it as a coach. So for me, when I watch, say, someone like Gary Neville, he's educating me every time I listen to him, rather than just telling me right.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, that's
you
okay.
I've got to say, I think he's done out. I didn't think Gary had it in him, but I've got to be honest with you, it's a breath of fresh air. He's absolutely fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and then that's the point I'm making, that when I want to watch, I mean, okay, I've done my coaching badges, I've got a team, you know, I've done, you know, I used to teach PE and I played football. I think I know the game a bit. So when I'm watching it, I want to be educated. I want to be told something that I didn't know before, which is why listening to pundits like you, like Gary Neville, it's educating me. Give me that little bit extra rather than just telling me what I see in front of me. And that's boring. But anyway, we'll come back to that later. I want to talk about England. And in your era, was getting the call up and playing for your country the pinnacle? Now, I say this because I'm not sure in this current era, some players have the same desire to play international football. Am I being too cynical, Colton?
Yeah, you're being too cynical. If you're a professional footballer, everybody wants to play for their country. You know, if you're picked for your country, that means that in that manager's eyes, whoever's the manager, you are one of the best 20 players or whatever in that squad that he picks. And very rarely do managers, you know, over, you know, when an England manager picks a team, it's very rare that he picks a player that's not in the top of the, you know, the ratings or whatever as far as football concerned. So yeah, I mean, for, you know, for me, it was the greatest honour to be capped by my country. I mean, I've been capped, you know, people forget I've been capped since I was 20 years of age for England. You know, so you know, but as I say, it was a sad day when I didn't get selected under Terry Venables. I knew that was going to happen. I was told that before it happened, because, you know, I love Terry Venables as a bloke, but Terry Venables plays the game, doesn't he? You know, he wouldn't pick me because the press don't want me picked.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't go against the press. That's the way that Venables works. I was actually playing better football when I was at Leeds United than at the time when, you know, don't get me wrong, I was playing well at Sheffield Wednesday and deserved, in my opinion, to have been picked for England. But when I went to Leeds and went back to centre-back, I was playing good football. And if I was not going to be picked for England, no disrespect to Gareth Southgate, I wouldn't have been expected to be left out. And it said it all when somebody like Gary Pallister, who for me, was top draw.
Yeah.
Top draw. Six England caps, and he's sitting on the bench while Gareth Southgate's playing. And don't get me wrong, Gareth Southgate's a lovely bloke, but that's not right. But that is how Venners works with the press.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. You know, that is how it is.
Yeah. You know, mentioned already, but Sheffield Wednesday fans will stoutly and staunchly support you come what may for your service and your performance in the famous blue and white stripes. But it's not the same from fans from other clubs who felt that you, along with other players, to be honest, epitomise an England team, which failed to qualify for the World Cup in 1994. Now, from my recollection, I don't think there was a better player at the time to be Gazza's minder, as it were, and to give him the room to do his things. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, everybody needs a scapegoat, don't they? So they try to use me as a scapegoat. If they look at my win ratio every time I played in an England shirt, then they'll find out that it is pretty high, my win ratio. They were looking for a scapegoat. The simple fact was and is that we dropped silly points. We were 1-0 up against Norway in extra time and conceded a goal. We're 2-0 up against Holland at Wembley.
That's
and
right.
Ended up drawing the game 2-2. And unfortunately, Wembley was being renovated. There was some work being done at Wembley at the time. So what happened was we played played the first three games. I think it was the first two games or the first three games of that tournament, or the group stages at Wembley, which meant we would have to play the last three games away. Yeah. Well, you imagine now, you've got, we're involved in two cup finals going for the league. Arsenal players are involved in two cup finals playing for the league. Man United players, we played 78 games, the top players per season, and then having to go and play two games in the space of 3 days to qualify for the World Cup. And we were just out on our feet, to be fair.
Okay. Was Graham Taylor right to allow the television cameras access all areas during that infamous documentary?
Well, that's not for me to answer that one. That's down to Graham Taylor. Would I have done it? No. But that's down to Graham Taylor. I mean, I've done a lot of time for Graham Taylor, and I think the press have ridiculed Graham Taylor mercilessly for a man who's got a lot of dignity, a lot of pride. And it hurt me personally to see a human being ridiculed in the manner that he was, which was never deserved. I mean, you've got to remember now, there's all errors. There's things that happen in life that just you can't do anything about. When Graham Taylor took over the England team, you're looking at Gary Lineker coming to the end of his career. You're looking at John Barnes coming to the end of his career. You're looking at, you know, a load of players. When we went to the European League Championships in 92, you've got the likes of young Alan Shearer, myself, whatever. We ain't got 30 cuts between us.
Yeah.
And you're losing, you know, people like Mark Wright and you know, Des Walker and people like that who've got, you know, who've had 70 or 80 cuts, 90 cuts. So it's difficult. It takes time. This is what I'm talking about, timing. Teddy Venables, Euro 96. Look at the squad he had, and on home soil.
Yeah, fair enough. It's no secret that Paul Gascoigne is the favourite player you've played with. Can you give us any Gazza stories on and off the pitch?
Well, I'd never do that because, like I said, Gazza's a very, very good friend, and I would never want to make any publicity or anything of the back of telling Gazza stories. All I can tell you about is he's the best footballer I've ever played with, and I'll just tell you the one thing that he did when I made my debut. I actually made my debut against England in Russia, and then I made my debut at Wembley. And he asked me, what am I doing after the game? And after internationals, you can either get a limo and stay down or stay in a hotel or fly back. So I was staying down, and Paul Gascoigne said, what are you doing? I said, well, we're going to see a show and then going out for dinner. He said, don't worry, I'll sort out your transport. And we're staying at a hotel in London, and Paul Gascoigne had sent a stretch limousine for me and my ex-wife then, and it was filled with champagne and whatever, and we had the limousine all night. And when I got back to the hotel, I went to pay the guy, and he said, no, Mr. Gascoigne, he paid for everything.
Superb. That's exactly what I was talking about. Just something like that to give our listeners. I mean, brilliant. I mean, everyone we've asked who's ever, you know, spoken to or knows Paul has always got a great, positive, feel-good story like that about him. So thank you for that. As I mentioned earlier, you seem like you enjoy being a pundit, and your experience, the longevity in the game, it shows, it shines through. And as I said before, you speak as a coach rather than as a fan or a player or a manager. Is this how you actually see the game? Do you see it as a coach now rather than as a fan or a player?
Well, I think when you're a pundit, I think your job is to not sit there and not tell the viewers something that they don't know.
Yeah.
Your job is to show the viewers something that they can't see, that they're not looking for, right? So that's how I view a game. When I watch a game, I look, you know, it's like things like people will turn around and say, Hazard was the difference between Chelsea winning the title last season. Well, I turn around and say, yeah, fantastic player, had a great season. The signing that won him the title was Matic.
Yes.
That was the signing that won him the title.
Because he allows Hazard the space to do what he needs to do.
Exactly. Broke things up, got on the ball. He was the type of player that they needed,
absolutely,
right? And that would win him the title. Hazard would not have been able to do what he'd done in the manner that he did if they didn't have the player Matic in the side. And that was the signing that won him the title.
So
I would explain, if I was on, I would explain that in the game. Your room allows Fabregas to have, because
Excellent. Nearly finished, Carl. We've got some questions from our Facebook group page. If you don't mind staying on for a few more minutes.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, excellent. So I've got a question, first of all. I coach an under-11 team, as I mentioned earlier. What tips and hints could you give me to help me become a better coach? What should I do? What shouldn't I do with young footballers?
Well, I think for me, is don't make it too technical. The game's simple. Learn them the basics. Learn them to pass and control and dribble with both feet. Learn them those, the basics, passing, 5-yard passing, 10-yard passing, 15-yard passing, right foot, left foot. Let them learn the basics, dribbling with the ball, as many touches as they can on the ball, and keep it simple. Too many of these coaches now, they're too technical. The game's simple.
Yeah.
The game is simple. And it's played, if you look at Jose Mourinho, plays the game in a very simple manner.
Yeah.
Very, very simple.
Excellent. Losing 2 cup finals in the same year to the same team, how difficult was that to take?
Well, it was because we definitely deserved to lose the Rumbelows Cup, but we definitely deserved to win the FA Cup. And we felt, we always felt, and we talked about it, we felt that whoever won the first one would probably go on to win the second one. And that's the way it turned out. But it was difficult, but it was a magnificent achievement to get to 2 cup finals.
Excellent. Question from Bazza Smith. He says, how did you deal with the constant criticism you received as a member of England's midfield?
Well, I didn't, to be fair. I didn't. I mean, I was voted England's best player in 92 in the European Champions. I received at numerous occasions Man of the Match awards for England. If you remember when we played Holland at Wembley,
yes.
You look at the players that were on view, Rijkaard, Ullit, all of these players, the manager at the time, Dick Advocate, said the best player on the park was Carlton Palmer. So within the game,
yeah.
I got plenty of plaudits.
So people who understand, basically.
Sorry?
People who understand the game rather than the tabloid press.
Exactly. Mm. So that, you know, for me, it wasn't a problem. You know, at the end of the day in life, it's one of those things, and I'm very, very lucky in life. I've always been able to look at myself and being honest. And if you look at yourself and be honest, right, then there's not an issue going forward. So the press can... And Pearce, Stuart Pearce had said to me one time, right, he said to me, Colton... Stuart Pearce had said to me one time, he said, Colton, if you need to read the newspapers to see if you've played well or not, then you don't know and you're not being honest with yourself. So I didn't need to read the newspapers.
Good
I knew
point.
If I played well,
yeah.
I knew if I played bad, and I would be honest with myself. And if I hadn't done well or hadn't done well in a particular area, then that is what I would work on in training to improve.
Good point. Nodas from Greece asks, if there's one career change you could make looking back, what would it be and why?
If there was, I would have gone and played abroad. I had the opportunity to go and play abroad and I didn't do it. And now having coached in Dubai and now out in Shanghai at the moment, I think it would have broadened my horizons a lot more. And I do regret that.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, I'm pretty lucky. I mean, to be honest with you, I've had a fantastic career and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Excellent. My brother Rico asks, did you intentionally ignore Graham Taylor when he called out your name? He says a million times in that documentary and he kept going, Carlton. Did you, or were you just so focused on the game you didn't even know?
No, I never heard him. So, you know, from the touchline, you know, unless you go up to the touchline or the manager called you, I basically blank the managers out. I know what my job is and I just get on with it.
Sure. Jamie Caron asks, which manager got the best out of you and who would you never sign for if you had your career over again?
Well, all the managers, every club I played at, I've made, in my opinion, big contributions. Favourite manager, Ron Atkinson. Enjoyed working with Howard Wilkinson. Obviously, the managers that took over at clubs, I mean, I wouldn't go and work with George Graham. And I never did. He took over at the football club. Trevor Francis, would I go and work for him? Not really, no. But these were managers that didn't sign me. These were managers that took over at clubs where I have. But every manager that signed me, I'd work for again.
Excellent. Colin, how good a cook are you?
I'm not a great cook, but I won't come die.
I know. How was it with Ruddock, Fashion and Worthington? Because you actually won come dine with me, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, no, great lads. I mean, Razor's just texted me today to play
Fantastic.
It was tough. It was tough work, but good fun.
Excellent, excellent. And what's your top break in snooker? Because I know you're a big fan.
Yeah, I haven't played for ages now, you know, for a long time. So I couldn't tell you what it was. But I used to play, I used to have a table in my house in the UK. And me and Prince Nazim used to play each other. Both home and away, he'd have a table at his house. So we used to do that. And then in the early days, down at snooker club with Imre Virardi and Mickey Thomas, we used to be always out there, you know. So I loved snooker. But yeah, I haven't played. I can't tell you the last time I played.
Oh, okay. Excellent. And finally, what's next for Carlton Palmer? I mean, you've had a successful career in football. You're still involved in punditry and you're coaching. You've tried your hand in the property market. And there's the football school in China that you talked about. What's next?
Well, no, I'm just going to continue what I'm doing. I'm negotiating with the TV company in China now to do football. I'll carry on coaching. I've got, you know, I'm just going to... you never know what opportunities present itself. We've got another year left on our contract in Shanghai, and we'll see what happens from there. I've got the three kids in university now. Hopefully, my first one will graduate next summer from law in Birmingham. So, just see the kids be happy and just keep having fun.
Excellent. Anytime you're in London, you can come and help me coach my under-11s. You're welcome.
Yeah, no problem. I will do.
Colin, huge thank you for your time and your honesty. It's been an absolute pleasure. Hopefully we can get you back in the future during one of our review shows.
No problem at all, mate. No problem at all. Thanks very much for having me on.
No, brilliant. It's been an hour's worth of pleasure, and I know that our listeners will really enjoy it. Thank you very much, Carlton, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks a lot, mate. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So this has been Shoot the Defence. That was Carlton Palmer. I'm sure you'll agree. It was a great interview, great stories, great insight, and hopefully you enjoyed it. This has been Michael Pieri, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.